Paul Naraki up there in Beacon, New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
Think you're going to put on the sandwich board this morning?
Well, I don't think today, but I may do it again.
All right, but you were standing in the crowds at Grand Central Station last Monday and Friday. What does your sandwich board say?
Almost homeless, looking for employment, experienced operations and administration manager.
How is the response? How is the response?
Actually, it's been great.
But no real job offers yet, right?
Not yet.
You're 59 years old. You've just finished putting your daughter through college. Your 401k is gone, and you run out of benefits when?
Well, my benefits are paid through the end of October. If I can't come up with this month's benefits, I'm done.
But you got so much attention for showing up in public wearing a sandwich board.
Yeah, that's true.
So, Paul, here's an idea. Clearly you're having an impact, even though you've got no job offer. What about selling ads on your sandwich board?
That's a thought. I hadn't even considered that.
I mean, the auto companies, they can't afford to advertise on TV right now. What would you charge Chevrolet for a morning at Grand Central on the Naraki board with their ad right there next to Almost Homeless? What would you charge them?
Oh, my gosh. I hadn't even given that a thought. That's a great idea.
So what are you going to charge them? No. Come on. Come up with a number.
Oh, I don't know. $500 a day.
Paul, you're selling yourself short. $1,000. Come on.
$1,000? Sure. All right.
Very reasonable. $1,000 a day to get your company logo on Naraki's big board. I love the sound of that. The big board. Almost employed. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, November 13th, and I wonder, John, if any advertisers are going to give him a call there.
Get on the big board, yes. Paul Naraki. Good morning, Adora.
Good morning. Today, we're going to take a look at global markets that are on a downward sliding. They're sliding downward. We'll go to London to find out what's happening. And making your brain stronger with your feet, it works, at least according to some scientists, and we'll tell you how it's done. Those stories are coming up, but first, these headlines.
Dealing with the recession, but no sandwich boards. Germany, one of the world's largest economies, is in recession, according to numbers released today. And here in the U.S., Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson is making big changes to the billion-dollar rescue plan. All that money was originally set aside to buy troubled mortgage assets, but the Secretary of the Treasury now has spiked that idea in favor of buying stakes in banks, and he's set to expand to help car and student loans and credit card debt. There's a party at Dick Cheney's crib today. The current VP will give Vice President-elect Joe Biden a tour of the official residence there in Washington, and they'll talk policy over dinner.
Crib, John?
Well, that's Mark. You know, he's writing the news today.
Uh-huh.
So Dick Cheney's crib. Yeah.
His home. Republican soul-searching content. Oh, don't go there, John. Just don't go there. Republican soul-searching continues today at the meeting of Republican governors in Miami. Many attendees are 2012 presidential hopefuls. Sarah Palin will speak on a panel discussing the future of the party.
And we are talking about unusual measures that could include wearing sandwich boards as a way of dealing with the recession. 877-8-MY-TAKE for your suggestions, or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And if you want to hire Paul Naraki, hey, give us a call.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
As the situation worsened, the facts change. And I will never apologize for changing an approach or a strategy when the facts change.
That's Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson yesterday announcing a change in tactics in confronting the economic meltdown. The new focus on consumer credit rattled U.S. markets, and this morning, Asian and European markets are following the lead. Stock index futures suggest a lower open on Wall Street today. Michael Hunter is a markets reporter for the Financial Times in London. He joins us. Welcome, Michael.
Good morning, Adora.
Clearly, the markets are not happy about this.
It's the uncertainty that's come with these unexpected changes which has really rattled the markets. One thing markets all hate right the way around the globe is a feeling of uncertainty, a feeling that they're not entirely sure what's going to be happening next. And where once we had clarity, we now have an element of confusion, and that's bad news for equities numbers on indices right the way around the world today.
Hypothetically, how do you think concentrating on the consumer credit markets will potentially help?
Well, it can prevent the spread of the crisis from its current location within the financial sector out down the tentacles of the system onto Main Street and onto what was people were referring to during the election campaign over there as Joe Sixpack. That may well be the intention. Whether or not it will be sufficient to do that, I think, remains unclear at the moment. But I think it's an effort to try and stop the worst effects of the crisis reaching ordinary people in the street.
But that question as to whether or not it will work, how does it affect the perception of how the U.S. Treasury is handling the crisis?
I think it shows that there is an element of uncertainty there, which is also compounded, Adora, by the government transition that we're going through at the moment that's happening as the Bush administration gives way to President-elect Obama's new administration. And, of course, there's an inbuilt element of uncertainty there. And the way in which the Treasury surprised people quite so much yesterday plays against that background, and it makes it sort of even more confusing than it would have been before. I don't think the U.S. Treasury looks particularly clever for that reason, but I think some of the changes that they're trying to make also show us that there's a real growing belief that some of these troubled assets that the plan is there to remove from the system might actually now be perceived in the market to be totally worthless. Well, we always knew they were worth nowhere near as much as they once were, but it now looks like they could be completely worthless. And government money being used to take stakes in banks is also a sign that they're trying to protect taxpayer exposure to those possibly worthless assets.
Well, they think that the stock is worth something, so that's what they're focusing on the bank side. But it seems as though the market is seeking a headline in this consumer credit sector. I mean, they're not bailing out my credit card debt or any consumer's credit card debt. They're bailing out people who bought securities that were based on credit card debt, and that Paulson is possibly signaling that there's a new tsunami related to credit card foreclosures that's about to hit the market.
I think that's very true, John. They're not directly bailing out people who are holding credit cards. Those of us who are using our Amexes and our Barclay cards or whatever else are not the people whom this is directly designed to help. But I think the fear amongst legislators and those fears seeping a little into the markets this morning, is that if we do have problems with the availability of credit to those companies, from the companies that provide us with those services, that could have very rapid and very damaging knock-on effects that would hit consumer spending, that would mean it would be more difficult for credit to be available on Main Street, and that would in many ways worsen the crisis. We could see phase two of a credit crunch at the retail level rather than the wholesale level. And although the wholesale problems will percolate through to some extent to the retail level, as they always will do, it's an attempt to try and stop that momentum from gathering and stop the problem from worsening. Whether or not it will work, whether or not that problem is as big a risk as people are thinking it is this morning, are questions that remain to be answered.
Well, Paulson's speech yesterday was a mix of impenetrable sort of acronyms and economic ease, if you allow me to coin a phrase there, and also a bit of style, attempting to project that, hey, I've got the whole situation in control. Listen to this, Michael.
I determined that the most timely, effective step to improve credit market conditions was to strengthen bank balance sheets quickly through direct purchases of equity in banks.
Now, he's talking about purchasing bank stock as a way of taking equity, but he's trying to project that, hey, I've got it in control here, but the markets aren't buying it.
I think the markets are still considering what they think about that. I think the way in which that is affecting sentiment remains to be properly determined by the market. I think it's this idea that before yesterday, we knew where we were with TARP. The Troubled Assets Relief Program was something that people understood how it had been designed. People understood what it was trying to do with which assets it was drawn up for. People are now less sure that they have a handle on exactly what's going on. the idea of governments taking stakes in banks, buying a lot of shares in banks, which hopefully will one day rise in value as the crisis eases, is something that was pioneered over here in the UK by Gordon Brown. And that seems to be an idea which is spreading and which is becoming more popular as governments struggle to deal with the worst effects of this crisis. And I think that idea itself, is quite well received in the markets. People quite like that strategy. What worries the markets about what's going on in the US Treasury at the moment is the sense of flip-flop, the sense that a plan which was wrangled through Congress in that dramatic series of votes, which we remember so clearly, should have held more water than it actually did. And the fact that they're having to redraw it has wider implications. And it's those implications which people are struggling to understand, rather than passing a judgment on the idea of governments taking stakes in bank equity.
You mentioned the transition to the Obama administration. How is that playing itself out? Obviously, all of these individual developments are happening with that backdrop. Is there confusion about who is in charge, or confusion about how the Bush administration will handle this until the Obama administration takes over?
I think there was an immediate little bit of a gap of knowledge in terms of who would be representing the new administration at the G20 meeting this weekend. News that Madeleine Albright will be representing Barack Obama there has helped clear up that immediate doubt about how effective that meeting could be with an outgoing president representing the US. In terms of the transition more generally, I think the way in which there's been such clarity from the existing administration in the White House and such a gracious cooperation, or what at least looks like a gracious cooperation between the president and the president-elect, has played very well, not just in the markets, but generally in Europe.
Well, it was funny, the Obama administration saying, or Barack Obama saying, he wasn't going to be at the G20, he was going to lay low. I thought to myself, he better have a pretty good disguise, because they're going to try to find him wherever he is. Again, it's the markets and the international community seeking clarity where there is none. What do you make of the numbers out of Germany this morning?
I think we knew that Germany, like many other European economies, was on the brink of recession. Everybody knew that that was the case. We're still digesting the exact meaning of those numbers. They were a little bit worse than the most optimistic forecasts were suggesting. Now, recession obviously can be many things. There can be a short, sharp, shallow recession, the best kind to have. What I think is worrying a lot of European economists and a lot of European investors at the moment is that there are growing signs that the slowdown and the recession which is brewing over here on this side of the Atlantic might not have those characteristics, might be longer and more grueling than previously thought.
And Michael, what are the indicators that the market's going to be looking to today in terms of the business news that will be released?
Well, we've been seeing defensive stocks faring quite well. Telecom providers have attained defensive properties as more and more people are using mobile phones. We've seen British Telecom and Vodafone, the biggest cell phone service provider in the world, doing very well today. Money has been moving out of the financial sector again as this uncertainty has returned into stocks that tend to fare better during difficult times.
Right.
So people are keeping a close eye on those kind of indicators.
Michael, if you've been at the FT for a long time, right?
I've been at the FT for 9 years.
Right,
now.
Right. I mean, if something should happen, God forbid, would you consider putting on a sandwich board as a way of getting a new job?
I think, when I was going through college, one of the jobs I did was meter reading. I used to knock on people's doors and read their gas and electricity meters, and I could always fall back on that, I think.
Michael Hunter has got a good plan B. Thanks so much. He's a markets reporter for the Financial Times, has been for the last 9 years. What's your suggestion?
I think we can solve two problems by instituting a national health care system. Therefore, the automakers would not have to pay millions of dollars every year for their retirees.
Looking for a plan B, or at least some sort of suggestion for the unemployed? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Something short of a sandwich board.
Yeah.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. A lot of economic numbers this morning to mull over. Foreclosures have increased by 25%, according to one survey, year to year. We're awaiting weekly jobless claims in about 10 minutes, and Germany has officially fallen into a recession. We've also been talking about a bailout for the auto industry all week because Democrats in Congress are talking about rushing one through in the upcoming lame duck session. One of our listeners had this suggestion.
This is Nick in Cliffside Park, New Jersey. Auto industry bailout? No, we need a takeover, not a bailout. We need to fire the top management of the auto industry and hire the newer, younger, more dynamic people who are going to give us a new generation of cars built in America that leapfrog over the Japanese, better than the Prius. It's not easy, but we can do it. Yes, we can.
So how do you launch away from current technology, leapfrog over existing technology, avoid a bailout which only preserves the auto industry as it exists now, but do something more visionary? It's a challenge for America's briefing book, and it's something definitely on the minds of the new administration and the people who will be dealing with both the auto industry and thinking about the visionary technologies we need to embrace in the future. It's why we asked Energy Roadmap author and editor and futurist, business consultant Gary Golden, to come into the studio to talk with us about this subject for America's briefing book. So, Gary, how would you advise a new president to make investment choices that will launch past the current auto technology, hybrid technology, into something completely unimagined at this point?
Sure. I would recommend to President Obama that he not put any further investments into the old combustion engine platform. So there's a growing sentiment within the automobile industry that the sector is moving towards electric motors that are powered by a combination of batteries, fuel cells, and capacitors.
So this is beyond hybrids even.
Correct. So a hybrid is a combination of a combustion engine and electric motor. You want to leapfrog into an all-electric platform.
Now, the Bush administration famously tried to invest in an all-hydrogen transportation platform, and it didn't really go anywhere. What do you think about that technology?
Well, those investments are actually paying off right now. So a hydrogen fuel cell vehicle is an electric car. This is a common, I think, misunderstanding within the general public that the only alternative to a combustion engine is an electric motor. How you power that motor is what's important. And the car is not an iPod. A car is a very complicated machine, and you're going to need a combination of batteries, hydrogen fuel cells, and capacitors working together to power that vehicle. So a hydrogen fuel cell car is the second generation of electric vehicles that we're likely to see.
What about current battery technology using, say, lithium ion or nickel metal hydride technology?
Sure. So even 3 years ago, lithium ion batteries were not considered to be ready for the automobile sector. But there have been advances in nanoscale material science that have enabled lithium ion batteries to overcome some of their performance challenges, which are mostly overheating. So there is a great deal of investment and scaling up of lithium ion batteries as the primary storage medium for these electric vehicles.
You know, some of this innovation has taken place in Michigan, particularly the battery technology innovations have taken place with some of the suppliers in Michigan around Detroit. But are you confident that the current sort of auto industrial companies are capable of taking this investment and moving into a completely different area? Or would you invest this money in brand new companies?
Yeah, that's my question.
Yeah, so I unfortunately, I'm not very confident at the moment. So what seems very clear based on investments made over the past 2 months and announcements made over the past 2 months from automobile leaders is that the electric vehicle is going global, and it's going global quickly. And if we look at energy, what are the components of an electric vehicle? It's electric motors and energy storage devices. And it seems clear that those energy storage devices are going to be built in Asia.
Really?
Who do you think is prepared to lead this kind of charge that you've just outlined?
I actually believe that General Motors is in the best position to leapfrog into this next age.
Because really?
What I believe is General Motors sees the problem. The problem is not oil. The problem is the combustion engine. We need to kill the combustion engine. We can't try to get more mileage out of a combustion engine. We just need to get rid of it. So General Motors has the foresight to understand it's how you build a car that makes them competitive, not how you fuel the car. And their vision is based off of an idea of a skateboard chassis. So you take all the motors and you put them in the wheels, and you take all the components that you need to drive a vehicle and you put it into a 10-inch thick skateboard chassis. One factory can produce multiple types of vehicles. You sell the tops separate from the bottom.
So it is like an iPod. You just put different skins on it.
Correct. But all of the propulsion systems and all the control systems needed to operate that car would be controlled or would be placed with inside this skateboard chassis.
And this is something currently being worked on.
The concept cars have been built and demonstrated, and as we – the problem is the batteries are too big, and that's why fuel cells come into play.
So maybe that is an argument for a bailout of GM. What do you think about the Volt technology that GM is talking about?
I'm very excited about the Volt because
I
think that it's a signal that we are done with the combustion engine, and we can no longer try to – build a hybrid or get better efficiency out of the combustion engine. We need to move on.
He likes the Volt. Gary Golden is editor of the Energy Roadmap. He's a futurist and consultant with a page for Barack Obama from America's briefing book about the future of transportation technology. And now Femi Okeh has some headlines.
Thanks, John. The time is just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. The Treasury Department has changed course. They're no longer buy toxic assets from failing banks. Instead, they will inject money directly into banks with the hopes that they will encourage banks to lend more. Secretary Henry Paulson says the early plan to buy troubled assets only made the financial crisis worse. Wall Street didn't like that decision much. The Dow fell more than 400 points yesterday. Most Asian markets followed suit this morning, with Japan's Nikkei index closing down at more than 5%. In fact, one international organization is saying that all 30 of its members face recession. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development says GDP is likely to decline by 0.3% in 2009. The Obamas and Bushes met on Monday, and the VP families meet today. Dick and Liz Cheney are hosting Joe and Jill Biden in a ceremonial visit, including a tour of the vice presidential residence. Polish archaeologists uncovered a church in Syria that is over 1,200 years old. It could be the largest ever discovered in the Middle East. The roof of the church is over 49 feet high. And finally, even the very, very, very rich are watching their pennies at the moment. Christie's auction house sold almost $140 million worth of contemporary art last night in New York. It sounds pretty good, but it was only half the pre-sale estimate, and that estimate was set very low. So a third of the lots went completely unsold, including a rejected self-portrait of Francis Bacon. That should have raised about $40 million. And Christie says that the art market is adjusting down.
Yeah, in fact, that was a disaster. An auction. They had one on modern art the night before, which was also a disaster.
Sotheby's, yeah, disaster. Yeah. Good time to buy art.
Right.
If you have money.
Bargains. Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. The American poet Wallace Stevens may have been onto something when he said, perhaps the truth depends on a walk around the lake. A new study by University of Michigan researchers concurs, reporting a walk through nature is not only relaxing, but makes you smarter. Jonah Lehrer joins us now from the studio of our partners WGBH Boston. Jonah is a science writer and author of Proust Was a Neuroscientist. Good morning, Jonah.
Good morning.
Okay, this sounds obvious. Walks, a daily constitutional is good for your heart and soul. But how in the world is it going to make me smarter?
Well, but the experiment was rather simple. The scientists simply had a large group of undergraduates take two different walks. One group walked through downtown Ann Arbor, Michigan, full of traffic lights and traffic and, you know, shops with alluring windows. And the other group walked in a nature, took a walk in nature, took a walk in the woods. And they came back and took a test of working memory where you're given a list of numbers and you have to recount them backwards. And sure enough, people who walked in the woods did much better on the test. They call this attention restoration therapy. And the idea is that walking in the woods is like a vacation for your prefrontal cortex, which is the part of the brain that directs attention and is responsible for big chunks of human intelligence.
So would the converse of that be people living in urban centers are getting dumber?
Not necessarily dumber, just we should be aware that being in a city is mentally exhausting for the brain. I mean, there's so much you have to keep track of when you're walking in a city street. You have to watch out for those cars. You have to pay attention to the honks. You have to wait for the walk signal. You have to make sure you're not getting lost. All that stuff takes, you know, cognitive effort. It's hard work for the brain, and it's important to recognize that living in a city isn't easy and has real cognitive effects.
Well, then I've been in a wheelchair for 35 years and haven't walked for that time, so how stupid am I, Jonah? I mean, come on. I live in a city, and I can't walk. I mean, it's over for me pretty much.
Well, it's obviously not walking. It's about, you know, I mean – to me, the most interesting part of the study is the idea that when we're in a city, we're always having to pay attention to stuff. And it's that act of directed attention that takes real effort. Whereas when we're walking in the woods and you see a beautiful sunset, that doesn't take effort to look at. We just admire it for about 30 seconds and then we move on. Or we see a pretty bird and then we move on.
If you're walking in the woods and you see a beautiful sunset, somebody sawed all the trees down. So you know,
true.
You know,
good point. So that might not be a nature walk.
At Princeton, though, at the Institute for Advanced Study, Albert Einstein and Kurt Gödel, two of the most brilliant people who ever walked the face of the earth, used to famously every single day take walks in the woods on the Princeton campus.
Well, they clearly knew how their brain worked.
Yeah, no kidding.
And they're not the only ones. I think there's a large literature of people from Thoreau to Einstein who advocate taking walks in the woods as a means of kind of restoring cognitive function and clearing your head regenerating the brain.
Jonah, you talk about how when we are relaxed, our brain is able to make connections that give us those eureka moments. What's actually going on in the brain when we have those epiphanies?
This is a separate stream of research, and this is done by researchers at Northwestern. And they've shown that when the brain is relaxed, when you're in that relaxed state, which you're more likely to be in when you're walking in the woods apparently, that's when your brain is most likely to have one of these epiphanies, one of these aha moments. And that's why also aha moments come in the warm shower, because you're relaxed.
And they don't come when you're waiting for traffic.
Exactly. They're probably not coming when you're waiting for a taxi. Trying to flag down a taxi on Fifth Avenue. But what happens in your brain when you're in this relaxed state is your brain is able to shift into right hemisphere mode. You're more likely to pay attention to these more disparate connected thoughts in the right hemisphere. And that seems to be more likely to generate an epiphany.
But for those who don't necessarily live near nature or the woods or lovely parks, isn't that state of relaxation relative? In other words, being in traffic, as John just said, in the middle of downtown New York City, that would be very stressful. But strolling through Central Park, which is quieter in comparison, that would provide more relaxation for your brain.
Absolutely. I think it depends on which part of Central Park. I mean, you're absolutely right to point out this is all relative. And so if you can find a city walk that is relaxing for you, then by all means take it and, you know, wait for an aha moment. But the point is that generally when we're walking in a city, the brain has to work harder than when we're walking in the woods. So they use two extreme examples in their experiment. And I think the scientists would readily agree that if you find a relaxing walk in the city, it should be just as good as a walk in nature.
But it's interesting that the research really does show that the exercise component of the walk has nothing to do with, or at least from what you're saying, has nothing to do with the sort of cognitive component of the walk's benefit.
oh no, this is nothing to do with walking. To show that they also showed subjects just pictures of nature and pictures of cities. And sure enough, just looking at a picture of nature was relaxing enough to actually induce some cognitive benefits. So this has nothing to do with escalating your heart rate. This is all about the brain.
Jonna, can you just hold on for a second? I need to print out some pictures of nature.
We need to get something up on the walls here in the studio. Yeah. So last time we talked to you, Jonna, you were a single guy.
Yes.
And that's changed.
I've now got something on my left finger, on my left fourth finger.
How much of your brain is focused on, dealing with marriage and the future?
It's proven to be very relaxing so far.
That's good.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Jonna Lehr's our Takeaway Science contributor. He's a writer and author of Proust Was a Neuroscientist. I sort of climbed on you there.
You did. You jumped on me. Anyhow, we did have a lovely response from one of our readers who said, what a surprise. Evolutionary psychology has largely been debunked by the discovery that the human genome is vastly smaller than assumed in the early days of the Human Genome Project. But we don't need science to tell us that for hundreds of thousands of years, humans and our ancestors did all thinking in rural and pastoral settings.
The real question is how inimical to human well-being urban chaos is. We all should move out of cities. I don't know if that can happen, but it would be news if it did, and Femi Oke would have the headline.
Thank you very much, John. Hi there. The time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. In Pakistan, police say that an Iranian diplomat has been kidnapped by gunmen in the northwestern city of Peshawar. His driver was shot and killed. And at the United Nations yesterday, Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari met with Condoleezza Rice and pressed for the US to end cross-border missile attacks between Pakistan and Afghanistan and for the US to stop those attacks between those two countries. And the US has used unmanned drones to launch 18 strikes at suspected military targets on the border. It's official, Anheuser-Busch shareholders voted yesterday to sell the company to Belgian rival InBev for $70 a share. The $52 billion acquisition creates the world's largest brewer with more than 300 brands, including Budweiser, Stella Artois and Beck. Doctors in Germany say that a man who was HIV positive appears to have been cured by a bone marrow transplant from a donor with a genetic resistance to the virus. Catherine Hankins is the science advisor to UNAIDS, and she says the transplant is an important development.
This case is going to be an important step forward in trying to discover what are the correlates of protective immunity. How could it possibly happen?
There have so far been no documented cases of a patient beating HIV, but researchers say that more tests are needed to prove the claims.
Trade deficit down and jobless claims up, just released. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome, John.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And with unemployment at a 15-year high, it's nice to know that somebody's hiring. There's a place in Washington that's actually in the midst of a mad frenzy for applications. The address is 1600. You want to take this down? Pennsylvania Avenue. Okay. Yes, the Barack Obama administration is soliciting people for positions all throughout government. And here to talk about what seems to be a fairly intrusive application process is Jackie Collins of the New York Times, who's on the line with us from the Washington Bureau there at the New York Times. Jackie, thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Good morning.
So the Obama administration, I think, obviously, as any new president would want to do, is be very careful about who it is that they're hiring, make sure they're qualified. But this goes beyond simple qualifications, right?
Oh, it sure does. I mean, you have to be very conscious of what could be a political problem. And so people that could be very successful in their lives by what they've said and written, all of a sudden a sentence or paragraph in those writings or speeches could pose a problem. And any number of financial interests, not only your own, but your spouse or your children. So public life being what it is, they can't be too careful.
Who's perfect, Jackie?
Well, and not Barack Obama, because on that questionnaire to enter his administration, like most questionnaires of that sort, when you have a presidential transition, you have to, you know, enter anything that could possibly be an embarrassment if it was learned about you. So imagine if Barack Obama weren't the president-elect, but someone applying to be in another president's administration, he might have to give a copy of his book, Dreams from My Father, and specify, point to the part that, you know, talked about his use of illegal drugs as a youth. And, you know, it's that sort of thing. There are no perfect people when it comes to politics. So we do the best we can.
It's conceivable that Obama himself might not pass this test, but there's a whole section on domestic help and the immigrant status of domestic help. Facebook pages have to be submitted. Jobs with government agencies that might have gotten in trouble over the last 18 months. What
right.
else?
Well, just about everything. And all that information, every you know, brokerage statement you've ever had in the last 10 years, and, you know, every mortgage and the terms of it, every loan over $10,000. And it's interesting you mentioned the Facebook page. I mean, every administration has its own innovations for these sorts of resume questionnaires, and that's Facebook, you know, didn't exist before any other administration. So that's a new one.
You can imagine people applying, sending videotapes of their ministers delivering sermons as a way of preempting that sort of problem. But can you read for us question 63 after you get to the end of all these questions and all this intrusive data that you have to put on the application? There's this question 63.
I don't have it in front of me, but it basically just says, all right, forget all the answers to all the other questions. Tell us what anything that could possibly embarrass us.
Yeah, I'll read it for you. Please provide any other information, including information about other members of your family, that could suggest a conflict of interest or a possible source of embarrassment to you, your family, or the president-elect. I don't think I could answer that. How about you?
No.
No, we're all out, so I guess we're going to have to stick with our jobs, Jackie.
It's almost like, give us the rope to hang you.
Yeah, Jackie Collins, New York Times from Washington, on the application process in the Obama administration.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Thursday, November 13th. Emmy Okay is here with the headlines.
Thanks, Adora. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Jobless claims exceeded estimates and have reached a seven-year high, now jumping to 516,000. And there's been a record decline in the price of crude oil, which has helped to push the U.S. trade deficit down to its lowest level in nearly a year. Now, it took a while, but results are now in for Alaska's One House seat. Incumbent Don Young won, and the Republicans will hang on to the seat. The Senate race there is still in question, though. Alaska Republican Senator and convicted felon Ted Stevens now trails his rival, Democrat Mark Begich. But after officials tallied piles of absentee and early ballots, Begich pulled ahead. No winner yet, since there's still plenty of votes left to count. And even if they hang on to that Senate seat, it's still a tough time for the GOP. Republican governors hope to change that. They're gathering in Florida to talk about the future of the party. And they've got some half-dozen presidential hopefuls in their midst. And Sarah Palin speaks today. That's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
We're going to move to the Obama administration to come, that is. In January, when the Obama family moves into the White House, Michelle Obama has said that she's going to be mom-in-chief. She's certainly undergone a remarkable change from hospital executive and primary breadwinner to now mom-in-chief. But her emphasis on steering clear of power within her husband's administration raises some questions about today's modern woman. Rebecca Traister, a staff writer with Salon.com, has a few thoughts on this. Welcome, Rebecca.
Hi.
You call it, or you refer to it as, the momification of the next first lady. Explain that.
Well, I think that one of the things we've seen happen to Michelle Obama over the course of the campaign is a concerted effort to make her into the kind of woman that is not at all threatening to an American people, a mom, a wife, a sister, a daughter. Her relationships to other people have been so emphasized so as not to make anyone uncomfortable with the fact that she, in fact, is a very high-powered professional American woman.
Let's listen to Valerie Jarrett, who's a very close strategist and confidant of the Obamas, talk about how she sees Michelle Obama's priorities as First Lady, or what Michelle Obama's priorities will be as First Lady.
The interests that she's had so far have been focusing on the work-life balance. She was a working mom. She knows how hard it is to manage being a mom, a spouse, have a professional job. And she has a lot of support. She's the first to say, look, I did it with all the support. She's also been focusing on military spouses and the challenges that they're up against. Volunteerism is another issue that's so important to her.
That's Valerie Jarrett speaking on Meet the Press on November 9th. What does that say to you?
Well, again, I think it's about making somebody digestible. There has been a lot, as we know, there has been so much conversation and change in terms of how America is coming to view race and gender during the course of these primaries, during the course of the election. Michelle Obama was a particularly threatening figure within a world that has traditionally been about white male power. She is this high-earning lawyer. She was Barack Obama's mentor when he was a summer associate. That's how they met. In many ways, she was as powerful or more powerful than her husband. And, you know, up until Hillary Clinton was the first First Lady we ever saw who had a postgraduate degree. This country is still not comfortable with women who are professionally or economically threatening or politically threatening, as we saw, you know, certainly during the primaries and during the general election. We're still very uncomfortable with female political power. And so what Valerie Jarrett is saying is, don't worry, Michelle Obama is just like all of you. She's a mom. She's a working mom. She's balanced. Now these issues that she's going to be dealing with are very real issues that are very closely tied to issues of political and economic parity for women. But they're being cast as a very comfortable mom role that everybody in America can feel okay about.
And there is a huge contradiction there, right, between a modern woman who is independent, she was the breadwinner of the family up until a couple of years ago, and essentially the role that they're outlining looks like the same role of any first lady, say, even 200 years ago.
Yes, and Michelle Obama is not a first lady of 200 years ago. It's incredible. Again, I do think there are some stealthy things happening here. The question of the balance of working families, again, is absolutely key to professional parity for women and professional economic power for women. In fact, this is something that Barack Obama has written about pretty extensively in The Audacity of Hope, happening within his own family, that as his career moved forward and they had children, the responsibility often fell to Michelle. Now, she still continued to be a very high-achieving lawyer and hospital executive, and in fact, on salary alone, was making more than him in 2006. But the question of how children get cared for, where the division of domestic labor goes, is a question that's absolutely fundamental to feminism. But we're certainly not, you know, we're not hearing about that. We're hearing about she's going to be, working on behalf of moms. As you say, this very feminized casting of very feminized, very comfortable, very traditional casting of the role of First Lady.
Just to play devil's advocate, isn't part of being a modern working mother is having that choice? Perhaps this is exactly what Michelle Obama wants to do at this point in her life.
That's entirely possible. I will say that there was quite a bit of reporting. I'm sure Michelle Obama does want to do this, and let me just be clear. Of course, being, first of all, the mother to those girls and the father to those girls is going to be of enormous importance to both the Obamas, I'm sure. How could it not be? This is a huge transition. These are small children. In no way, I don't think, is anyone trying to suggest that the focus on parenting them and adjusting them and making sure everything's all right with them is a top, if not one of the top priorities. I'm sure she's committed to doing it. I'm sure she wants to do it. But this is also a woman who had an independent career that was totally unrelated to her husband's. a very ambitious and focused career woman. And while I'm sure there are a million happy and wonderful things about the Obamas going to the White House, and I'm sure there are a million happy and wonderful things for Michelle Obama, I guess my question is that in all the fretting over the transitions that, for example, Sasha and Malia are going to have to make, or that Barack himself is going to have to make in a move from Chicago to, you know, a Chicago-style shop to Washington, mm-hmm. why there's less concern over what kind of transition it will feel like for a woman who's used to having an independent identity, her own paycheck, her own world that she goes to work in every day, separate from her home. What's it going to feel like to lose those things and become an extension of her husband?
Is she really going to lose those, Rebecca? I mean, I'm just wondering if you're personally offended by the style of this sort of rollout of Michelle, and if there maybe is an argument that, hey, look, they're just trying to make the transition easier by not repeating the mistakes of the Clintons, who were so sort of bold and talking about, you know, baking cookies and saying things that just sort of were off the cuff and ultimately became fodder for people who wanted to attack them.
Well, I think they are trying to not repeat what happened with the Clintons, but it makes me sad, actually, that that's the way it has to go. And by the way, if this is what they need to do, then this is what they need to do. This is not just personal judgment, like this is bad. I just wonder why we don't, you know, why there isn't as much consideration of how it would feel for an individual to totally lose her individuality in the public eye for the next 4 years or 8 years. And in terms of what happened with the Clintons, I think that was, we can talk about what mistakes they made, but that was also an American discomfort with a powerful and equally powerful woman. And so the fact that the way the Clintons talked about Hillary and her job was considered a mistake, in part has to do with an American unreadiness to accept a woman like Hillary Clinton and a woman very much like Michelle Obama, both high-powered lawyers and equals to their husbands.
You just gave us a whole lot of things to talk about, Rebecca Traister. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Rebecca Traister is a staff writer for Salon.com, and Vivian writes to us on our website saying, just because at this time Michelle Obama wants to be a traditional mom does not mean that this is the way she is going to be the whole 4 years or 8 years, thinking positively there, Vivian. Just relax. Maybe they are going to take it one day at a time, move in and get everyone adjusted and see what Michelle would like to do instead of making pronouncements without knowledge.
And what about a plan B? I mean, have you thought about yours?
When I was going through college, one of the jobs I did was meter reading. I used to knock on people's doors and read their gas and electricity meters, and I could always fall back on that, I think.
I'm challenging you for the best job story, plan B story, fallback story. If you win, sorry, I can't promise you a job, but here's the challenge. What's the most daring or unusual thing you've done to get a job, like, say, a sandwich board? Have you ever worn one? Give us your creative suggestions and stories of what you've done at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We've gotten some great ones so far, but I'm sure there are more out there.
Yeah, what was the most clever plan you ever put together that actually worked? Or maybe it didn't work and you still thought it was the best plan you ever came up with.
Dumbest ideas welcome.
Yeah, dumb ones are ones that didn't work. That sounded good but didn't work. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Okay, Secretary Paulson, how are we doing?
8 weeks ago, Treasury took responsibility for supporting the agency debt securities and the agency MBS through a preferred stock purchase agreement that guarantees a positive net worth at each enterprise. Effectively a guarantee on GSE debt and agency MBS.
Hank, you lost me there. Wall Street got some message, though. After the Treasury Secretary spoke yesterday, the markets dropped more than 5%. Rereading Paulson, hiding under the tarp, MBS. I get the BS part. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
It's Thursday, November 13th. Good morning. And that was a lot of acronyms. I'm trying to form my thought here on that.
One was clear to me. Good morning, Adora.
Good morning, folks. We'll look at the slugfest runoff in Georgia regarding the Senate race there. John McCain is jumping in today. And a setback in California, gay rights advocates say, may actually open the door to an opportunity in Utah. Those stories are coming up, but first, these headlines.
Negative growth. You got to love that phrase. One of those phrases economists and politicians love because it makes a bad thing sound less bad. In this case, negative growth isn't growth. It's shrinking of the economy. And new numbers show Germany's economy has shrunk for two quarters in a row. It's now officially in recession, a big deal because along with the U.S. and Japan, Germany is one of the world's largest economies. Here in the U.S., Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson claims the $700 billion bailout plan is going okay so far, but there's a big shift in the use of all that money. Instead of using it to buy troubled mortgage assets, the government will focus on buying stakes in struggling banks. The hope is it will spur banks to start lending, but Congressman Barney Frank doesn't think so. We'll be talking about him in just a moment.
Alaska Republican Senator Ted Stevens now trails his rival. Stevens did lead Democrat Mark Begich, but after officials tallied piles of absentee and early ballots, Begich pulled ahead. More votes to be counted, but Democrats like their chances. Here's party spokeswoman Bethany Lesser.
Obviously, there's absentee votes that haven't been counted yet in question ballots, but we just expect these trends to continue and are really cautiously optimistic.
There is a winner in the Alaska House race, though. Republican Don Young will hang on to his seat. Democrats thought they could knock off the longtime congressman, but they didn't succeed.
A transplant may have cured AIDS. An American patient got bone marrow from a donor immune to HIV. His doctors now say there's no longer any sign of the virus in his body. Researchers caution it's not clear how this worked or whether this treatment can be worked on a large scale, but it is definitely something to investigate. I've got a challenge for you, though. I want your best story. If you win, I can't promise you a job, but I can promise your story will get on the program. Here's the challenge. What's the most daring or unusual thing you've done to get a job? Give us your creative suggestions and stories of what you've done at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Could be a smart idea. Could be a dumb idea.
Or, even better yet, how did you keep motivated despite a number of setbacks, let's say? What kept you going?
Well, that's obvious. Getting on our program. That's the motivation. That's clearly. It's the entire economy is floating on this.
That's good to know. That's very good to know. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Three numbers out this morning. All are continuing signs of a deepening global recession. First of all, Germany is officially in recession. Europe's largest economy is shrinking, as we noted at the top of the program. Also, jobless claims have reached a seven-year high. Initial jobless claims, the weekly number, is definitely showing that the recession is deepening. The trade deficit is down. Sounds like good news, but it's also a sign of the recession because of crashing oil prices. Latest economic numbers show that there's all kinds of things for Congress to pay attention to, and Congress is really scrambling to deal with all of the transformations in the economy, including a Treasury Secretary, Hank Paulson, who seems to be changing the rules of his own rescue plan.
Overall, we are in a better position than we were, but we must address the continued challenges of a weak economy, especially the housing correction and lending contraction.
Yesterday, the Treasury Secretary announced that the bailout would not be buying bank assets as much as it would be bailing out securities that might include consumer debt. That change was not reacted to well by Wall Street. It was down 5%, both the S&P and the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Is Congress scrambling to deal with a Treasury Secretary that's making up the rules as he goes along? Joining us now, we're very pleased to have with us the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, Barney Frank, a Democratic representative from Massachusetts, joining us on the phone from Washington. Congressman Frank, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
How much are you scrambling to deal with what looks like a shift in emphasis by the Treasury Secretary, and how's the oversight going on this giant $700 billion rescue?
Well, the oversight of the money they are spending has been progressing. We are very unhappy and have made it clear that the money that was used to buy stock in banks has not been used by all the banks the way it should have been. That is the purpose of our buying stocks, and that was one of the things we did tell the Secretary to do. That was not a problem from the congressional standpoint. In fact, he was initially reluctant to use that authority, and we put it into the bill. But too many of the banks that have received the share purchases have used it for other purposes, and it's only for relending. And, in fact, we will have a hearing next week in which we will have Secretary Paulson, Chairman Bernanke, and others, and they will hear a lot of anger from members of Congress about a failure to insist that this money be relent. But today we are dealing with a new issue that he raised yesterday, and that is it is not that we disagree with what he is doing. All the things he's doing, we had, in fact, authorized him to do. The key was his decision to do nothing at all to reduce foreclosures. You just cited that statistic about the increase in foreclosures. And we want to stress there's a compassionate reason to help some of the people who are facing foreclosure because they were misled. But the main reason for trying to reduce foreclosures is economic. It was the foreclosure crisis that was brought on by irresponsible subprime lending that got us into this mess. And it is necessary for us to get out of this mess to reduce the number of foreclosures, because you still have a lot of these mortgages that should never have been made in the first place but were and were sold to various people. And as they default, that just causes problems everywhere in the economy. So I was very surprised to have the Secretary say he's getting out of the business. Well, just one last point. A very good appointee of the Bush administration, Sheila Bair, who's the head of the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, has been in the lead in this for a long time. She has a very good proposal that builds on and extends some of the things we did in Congress to reduce foreclosures. Surprisingly to me, Secretary Paulson says, well, we work with her. That's now a good plan, but we're not going to do anything to fund it. And she has a good plan that will reduce foreclosures, and we ought to be using some of the money in the $700 billion to implement it.
Congressman, before we get back to the foreclosure issue, in terms of the relending, it's been reported that about all but $60 billion of the $350 billion that you've already authorized for the Treasury Department has been handed out. Who's gotten the money, and how much have they gotten? Do you know?
Yes. Nine big banks got $125 billion. The nine largest banks got a total of $125 billion. And we say got. We should be clear. This was no gift. And people should understand, of the first $250 billion, it is all very, very likely to be repaid in full, maybe with a slight profit, because we bought stock in healthy banks. We bought stock in healthy banks because we were told, look, banks are only allowed to lend a certain percentage of their capital. As this market has deteriorated, the capital that banks held has been deteriorating because it's in various securities that have been devalued in some ways. So the notion was, well, okay, now the banks can't lend as much because their capital has been shrunk. We'll give them money to relend. So and only the healthy banks. Now, $125 billion went to the big nine banks. A second $125 billion is in the process of being used to buy stock in the smaller banks. And then $40 billion went to frankly, back up the Federal Reserve's play with regard to AIG. Now, I do believe with all of that 290, the tax base is going to get it all back.
Well, but wait a second, Congressman Frank. I mean, as this has happened to the so-called healthy banks, Citicorp's stock's price dipped below 10 yesterday. I mean, how can you say that the taxpayers aren't on the hook when all of these bank stocks are tanking?
Because they are not going to go to zero. They are not going to go bankrupt. They have assets that protect us. And we also have preferred stock. We didn't buy common stock. So the value of our stock is not dropping. We got preferred stock, which pays 5% dividends. And we will be protected, because if we're in a superior position legally to those common stocks.
Which only means that they're paying you the dividend out of the federal treasury, though, right?
Well, we are insisting that they not do that if it is in any way going to jeopardize our recovery. And we are also trying to assess, and I think Treasury has been laggard in enforcing this, the money that we put in to buy shares has to be relent. They have to show an increase in lending activity. If after they've done that, they have money left over to pay dividends or do whatever, then they're free to do that, except that we do put restrictions on what can be paid to the people at the very top.
Congressman,
but we are going to be insisting, right, and that's the hearing next week, is for them to show us where the increased lending was.
Congressman Frank, did you see this story in Bloomberg News about their Freedom of Information Act request
to the Federal Reserve? Yes,
to the Federal Reserve for $2 trillion that apparently Congress agreed to be lent to smaller banks. What do you know about the $2 trillion?
Congress didn't agree to lend $2 trillion to smaller banks.
That's what the executive editor of Bloomberg News said the Federal Reserve told him.
No, in the first place, if Congress agreed, it agreed in 1935. The Federal Reserve's lending, unlike the Treasury, is being done under a statute that was passed during the Depression that gives them the right to lend money. I can tell you as a fact, when, for instance, they advanced the money to AIG, they did not ask us. They informed us. So the executive editor of Bloomberg is wrong, or somebody told him bad information.
Well,
we did vote $700 billion to be used with various safeguards that we put in. But the lending from the Federal Reserve has not been subjected to Congress. It hasn't been approved by Congress, and there's just no basis for that.
Well, but I'm not trying to pin you down here. What I am trying to get a sense of the oversight. Is it conceivable?
Well, I understand that, sir, but you made a statement that said Congress approved it.
That's just what I was told yesterday. I'm glad for you to set me straight on that.
You know, people tell you Elvis is alive.
All right.
I'm not accountable for everything anybody tells you.
Well, hey, Elvis is alive. That I don't want to get into. That's not controversial. But Congressman Frank, let's talk about the $2 trillion. Is it conceivable that they would have lent $2 trillion and that Congress would somehow not have been informed by that?
No, you were making a distinction here that shouldn't be made. I said we have been informed. We did not approve it. Your initial statement was that it was Congress approved, and that's not true. Informed, yes, but I think the $2 trillion must include the $700 billion. I don't know how they get to $2 trillion. It is true. The Federal Reserve did have the authority under this Depression-era statute to make loans. That's the loans to Bear Stearns. That's the loans to AIG. And then they have also been engaged in buying up commercial paper that couldn't otherwise be sold. So, yes, clearly they've been doing hundreds of billions of it, and they have informed us of it. It was, as I said, Bear Stearns, which we were told about after the fact, AIG, which we were told about after the fact. So, but it's not $2 trillion from the Fed. I believe the $2 trillion, one, I don't think it reaches $2 trillion, but two, it is, I think, the combination of that and the $700 billion. And finally, the overwhelming majority of that's going to be repaid. People shouldn't think this is $2 trillion added to the deficit.
All right. Well, I'm definitely looking forward to clarity on that. Do you have your first question for Ben Bernanke when the hearing opens next week?
Well, if I do, I don't think I should ask it on your radio program. If you'll forgive me, I think I'll wait and ask him.
That's right. Well, you don't want him to prep for it. But, I mean, I guess the main concern of your committee is why the banks haven't started relending,
yes,
right?
For this particular thing. We also, many of us, will be critical of the administration's failure to join us in supporting a vigorous economic recovery program. I mean, we need to do three things to get out of this terrible recession, the worst since the 30s. One, we need to get the money relent so the credit markets work. Now, the Secretary said correctly things are better than they were, better than they would have been if we hadn't passed this. But they'd be even better if the banks would do what we had expected them to do and relent that money.
No, and that is the mystery. Congressman Frank, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
Barney Frank, chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. He's a Democrat from Wisconsin, speaking to us from Washington.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
I said Wisconsin. Do you believe that? I don't know why. I don't know. He's, of course, a congressman from Massachusetts. I have a house in Massachusetts. Femi, okay, with the headlines, please, while I recover.
Hello there, John. 17 minutes past the hour. Wall Street is headed for a lower opening. This after Asian markets stumbled following a drop in the Dow yesterday. Japan's Nikkei and Hong Kong's Hang Seng both lost more than 5%. European markets are mostly flat. In Afghanistan, a suicide bomber struck a U.S. convoy today. Death tolls have varied, but officials now say that 8 civilians were killed, along with one American soldier. The bomb exploded near a crowded market in Jalalabad. The UN is stalling over whether to send 3,000 more troops to the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. The Security Council deferred the final decision until the 26th, and it's already the largest peacekeeping mission in the world. The Supreme Court ruled in favour of the Navy yesterday, saying it's OK to use sonar technology during training exercises. A federal judge had ruled the Navy had to take special precautions. Environmentalists say sonar can hurt whales, including endangered species. A spoof edition of the New York Times hit the streets of Los Angeles and New York yesterday. Readers opened the special edition dated July the 4th, 2009, to find the war in Iraq had ended and that there was free universal health care. So how did readers react when they realized they'd been fooled? Here's prankster Wilfred Sassoon.
They experienced a moment of disappointment and then smiled, realizing that all these things are indeed possible. And across the board, it was pretty much adored, I think.
The fake New York Times was created by the liberal prank group The Yes Men, and the real New York Times says they were enormously flattered.
And they're from Wisconsin.
And they're one of our partners, we should add.
Not the fake people.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Right now, drop, cover, and hold on. Drop to the ground immediately. Take cover by getting under a sturdy desk or table. Hold on to it until the shaking stops. If you cannot get under sturdy furniture, protect your head and neck with your arms.
No, that is not advice for dealing with the economic turmoil that's transpired over the last several weeks. It is actually the sound of a drill that people in California are preparing to be a part of, an amazing simulation of a 7.8 magnitude earthquake for the entire state of California. It's called the Great Southern California Shakeout, and joining us to talk about it is Patricia Nazario, reporter for KPCC, Southern California Public Radio, at our member station, KPCC in Pasadena. Patricia, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Good morning.
As we've seen over the last several years with Katrina and the tsunami in on the Pacific Rim, and even with the earthquakes in China, the scale, as the human population reaches 6 billion, of some natural disasters requires a complete rethinking of preparedness. And here, the Great Southern California Shakeout is preparing to involve more than 5 million people in an earthquake drill. How do you do that?
Well, it took a lot of time, preparation, planning. They set up a very informative website and with a big orange button that says register here. And that's what they did. You know, businesses, government offices, and schools got online and registered here. For example, the city employees in Los Angeles will be getting under the desks at 10 o'clock because LA Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa sent out a memo telling them to do so. And LAUSD, the second largest public school system after New York City, of course, has about a million students, teachers, and employees. They'll be doing it too, and they also registered online.
So a simulation has to contain some surprises to be a proper drill, but what details of the scenario do you know already?
What details of the scenario do I know?
Yeah, well, what they're going to be simulating today, what kinds of events that they want to focus on?
All right, well, the way it's going to happen is at 10 o'clock, the massive make-believe 7.8 magnitude earthquake quake rolls along the San Andreas Fault. And this is a likely scenario, according to what some researchers came up with in a study in 2006 from the University of San Diego. You know, they said that it's been about 100, well, it's been about, yeah, about 120 years since the last time the San Andreas Fault experienced an earthquake. The last time was the San Francisco earthquake and fire in 1906. That was on its northern tip. And it's been about 300 years, they say, since it had an earthquake on its southern tip, which is where we are. So they want to encourage people to think about it and to prepare. At least the very thing they can do is to protect themselves, but to begin to think beyond that and to begin to come up with a plan of action for themselves and for their families.
And at least one hospital is going to be involved in a scenario where perhaps hundreds of students are buried in a building collapse, right?
That's right. There's a hospital, Providence Holy Cross. It's right across the street from this school. And this, again, another likely scenario. This happened at the school in the 1994 Northridge earthquake. The building didn't fall on students because the earthquake happened at about 5 o'clock in the morning. But the campus was totaled. It was destroyed. So what they're doing this time is saying, okay, let's push the action time forward, say, 3 or 4 hours. Say it did happen during the middle of a school morning, and there were students on campus. So the students are going to start showing up at 7 o'clock Pacific time to put on their makeup, and there's going to be a news briefing at about 8:30. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa and Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger are supposed to be there, along with other city and county officials. And, they're going to, you know, work this out from 10 to 3 o'clock, and they're going to simulate this massive triage and this massive emergency response on the school's football field.
You know, one of the interesting things is that in a drill like this, the main benefit comes not only from getting people prepared to take cover in an appropriate way, as that sound at the top suggests, but also it empowers people to actually be rescuers, that most of the casualties are avoided when victims help each other, as opposed to ambulance or paramedics or first responders.
That's right, and you know, the better people are prepared, the more of a chance there is for people to do that. That's what experts say, that it's not a question of if it happens, but when a major earthquake like this happens in California. And they say the difference between a disaster and a catastrophe will be how well prepared people are.
So what are you going to be doing, Patricia?
I'll be working. I'll be covering it and observing and taking a lot of mental notes. And hopefully, you know, some of that stuff will stick. And, you know, when it happens, hopefully I'll be able to get myself in gear and get my family in gear. We'll be okay.
Getting into the spirit of the drill, Patricia Nazario, thanks for being with us. A chilling, sobering, but a very interesting earthquake drill taking place in Southern California today. Simulation of a 7.8 magnitude quake. She's a reporter for KPCC, Southern California Public Radio, that would be very involved in a real earthquake. So what's the most daring or unusual thing you've done to get a job? We're thinking about that in these economically challenging times.
Hi, this is Philomena from Westchester. The wildest thing I did to get a job was I went to a building that was, I knew from top to bottom, filled with lawyers, but couldn't knock on every door with my resume, so I selected the names that could have some meaning to me, and here I am 30-plus years later, still at the same law firm.
Have meaning for her. I wonder what that means. So the most challenging or daring thing you've done to get a job, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Call in to win. And we have headlines now from Femi. Okay.
Thanks, John. The time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. New unemployment claims jumped to the highest level in 7 years. This week, 32,000 people filed new jobless claims. That brings the number up to 516,000 people. It's the highest number since September the 11th, 2001. Officials in Afghanistan now say that at least 8 people, including one American soldier, were killed in an attack in eastern Afghanistan. Earlier statements have put the number of dead as high as 20. Defense Secretary Robert Gates says that Russia's proposal to Washington to scrap its missile defense plans in Eastern Europe is unacceptable. Gates says the system is designed to counter a potential threat from Iran. Disgraced former Republican Congressman Mark Foley is speaking out. He resigned his House seat back in 2006 after sexually explicit online chats he had with underage males and when they became public. Foley says that he's talking because it's time to finally apologize.
I embarrassed them and I embarrassed my family. And I wanted to have the chance in a public setting to lend my voice to what happened.
Prosecutors decided not to charge Foley. Russian President Dmitry Medvedev says that he's hoping for a better relationship with President-elect Barack Obama than he has with the current U.S. administration. Medvedev says that he has had a good telephone conversation with President-elect Obama and that they've agreed to meet face-to-face as soon as possible. And staying in Russia, prosecutors there have opened a criminal investigation against a sailor suspected of deliberately triggering the fire extinguishing system aboard a Russian submarine on Saturday. The incident caused the deaths of 20 people. And that's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And joining us now is Scott McCoy, who's a Utah State Senator on the line from Salt Lake City. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
To talk about what appears to be a possible opportunity in state politics in Utah based on the success of Proposition 8 in California. For those of you who paid attention on Election Day, Proposition 8 constitutionally in the state of California banned same-sex marriage. And that proposition, which was very controversial and generated enormous amounts of money in the campaign, it's the highest grossing ballot measure ever in California history, was apparently supported, that ballot measure, by the Mormon Church. Criticism of the Mormon Church in the wake of the success of Proposition 8 has caused Scott McCoy, Utah State Senator, to get an idea. What are you planning, Scott?
Well, we were kind of looking for the silver lining in this dark cloud that happened in Prop 8. And what we're proposing is, based on the church's statements, both during and in the wake of the Prop 8 battle, they came out and said, you know what, you know, we may be in favor of marriage in a traditional sense, but we're not opposed to giving limited rights to gays and lesbians, like hospitalization, medical benefits, probate, inheritance rights, and anti-discrimination laws. And so we basically got together and said, you know what, we're going to take the church at its word, and we think that, you know, if that is true, if you are not opposed to those types of measures, then guess what, we're going to introduce those measures here in Utah, and we're going to ask, and send an invitation out to sit down and come together and see if we can't find common ground on those kind of legislative measures and get them passed in the state of Utah, just like they've been passed in the state of California.
Now, the way you're describing it, it's unclear to me. Is this a legislative ploy to try to draw the Mormon Church into a debate that perhaps it doesn't want to get into, or do you actually think there's an opportunity here?
No, I think our offer is made in sincerity, and we hope that it's received the same way. I know a lot of LDS folks who are very conflicted on this issue. They are good folks who think that gay and lesbian folks should have some basic legal protections. And I take the church at its word. I think that they have very genuine and sincerely held beliefs about marriage. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we can't find something short of that that can be helpful to gay and lesbians in the state of Utah. And so this isn't a ploy. I'm sincerely hoping that we can find some common ground, and I hope that the church views this as an opportunity as opposed to some way to put them on the spot.
Now, you are an openly gay Democrat in the legislature there in Utah, and let's just be clear, you're not proposing an explicit endorsement of same-sex marriage. You just want an explicit set of protections for civil issues for same-sex couples in the state of Utah, right?
That's right. Marriage is not on the table in this discussion.
Will it ever be?
I personally believe in marriage equality and want to see that for us at some point in time in the future. But, you know, clearly in the state of Utah, that's going to be, quite a ways out. But our position is look, fine, let's set aside the marriage issue. We are going to have to agree to disagree at this point in time on the marriage issue. But that doesn't mean that, you know, you said you don't oppose, you know, say, for example,
I think the civil issue is clear, and we just have a couple of seconds. But it's interesting how the repercussions from California are creating an opportunity in Utah. Scott McCoy, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Scott McCoy is a Utah state senator. Proposition 8 in California may be creating opportunities for gays in Utah.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's time for the latest headlines of the morning from Femi Okeh.
Hello there. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. 9 are dead, including an American soldier, following a suicide strike on a convoy in Afghanistan. Earlier, U.S. officials thought that 21 people had died in the attack. This year is already the deadliest for U.S. troops since the war began there back in 2001. The world's largest exporter is now in recession. New numbers show that Germany's economy shrunk 2 quarters in a row, meeting the official definition of recession. Home foreclosures shot up 25% from last year. That's according to a real estate tracking firm. Nearly 300,000 homes got a foreclosure notice in October. And on a happier note, the Country Music Association Awards were last night. Kenny Chesney picked up his 4th Entertainer of the Year award, and George Strait won awards for Best Album and Best Single for this number.
I saw God today.
That's George Strait singing I Saw God Today. Strait is now the most honoured artist in CMA Awards history. My personal favourite is All My Exes Live in Texas. Carrie Underwood and Brad Paisley won the Best Vocalist of the Year award. That's a look at your news for this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
All My Exes Live in Texas.
It's very catchy. I'll play it to you later.
Here are some other words for you. Climate change, green jobs, a green economy. They're all buzzwords in the ongoing discussion about the environment. And they are all issues President-elect Barack Obama will be tackling in office. As we put together America's briefing book for him, we are joined by Van Jones, author of The Green Collar Economy, and he's also an environmental activist. Good morning, Van Jones, and welcome back.
Well, good morning to you.
Now, these are all very broad subjects, a green world, a green economy. What do you think the first priority should be?
Well, you know, the first thing we have to understand is, you know, the great challenge for this president is to beat global warming, but also to beat the recession. So, you know, the great insight here is that you can do both. You can power our way through the recession by repowering America with clean energy because, you know, everything is good for global warming is a job. Solar panels don't put themselves up. Wind turbines don't manufacture themselves. Buildings don't weatherize themselves. Every one of those things is a job. So what the president needs to do is to create a clean energy jobs corps to begin the process of repowering the country. And people say, well, how are you going to do that? You know, we're broke. You know, that's the number one thing. Well, the reality is that a lot of the work of making America more energy efficient and reducing greenhouse gases pays for itself in energy cost savings. For instance, if you weatherize millions and millions of buildings, blow in insulation, replace doors and windows so that they fit better, break out the caulk guns, you cut a lot of energy use because those buildings are now more efficient, but you also cut greenhouse gas emissions, but you also create lots and lots of jobs. That's the kind of thing that the president's going to have to do, come up with solutions that solve multiple problems at the same time.
Clearly, these are tough times, economic tough times. And over the summer, when the gas prices went through the roof, there was this sense of urgency by Americans that something had to be done about oil dependency. Well, the price of gas has shot down as a result of oil prices decreasing. How do you maintain that kind of urgency so that some of these goals can be executed?
Well, you know, the reason that the gas prices came down is because the whole economy collapsed. So, you know, that's not a secure route for the American people. We've got to be as smart as the Germans. The Germans don't, you know, ride the bucking bronco of oil prices to figure out what they're going to do for energy security in their country. They took American technology, which we developed in terms of solar power, and they said, guess what? No matter what the price of oil does this week or next Thursday, we're going to create a pathway here where we're going to support our solar industry. They are now the number one solar power in the world using American technology because the government stepped in and had a plan. We need that kind of a plan. We can't ride the bucking bronco of day-to-day oil prices to determine our strategy. As soon as the economy is back up on its feet, guess what? Demand is going to go back up around the world. We're going to be back in competition with Asia for oil and other resources rather than being able to be in cooperation with Asia, deploying clean and green technologies. So what we want to be able to do is to have a go-forward strategy. That's what the president should be focused on, not the day-to-day price of oil, but the long-term energy security and the jobs that come from growing a new sector in our economy.
Well, let's talk about those jobs once again, Van. I mean, there is a lag time here. You say they pay for themselves, but you can't pay workers with the promise of cost savings of some building they're putting solar panels on. I mean, you have to do upfront cash payments to actually employ people, and that could be very, very expensive. Do you have any numbers?
Yes. You know, the Center for American Progress, where I'm a senior fellow, we crunch the numbers. For about $100 billion, which used to sound like a lot of money and now seems like a rounding error. For about $100 billion, you could get 2 million jobs in the next 2 years repowering and retrofitting America. Now, and there's a smart way to do this. We may have to do some deficit spending in the short term, but the new president could create a revolving loan fund where cities and hospitals and universities could borrow the money, could retrofit their buildings, weatherize those buildings, put people to work right now, get those cost savings, and then pay the government back off those green grants over a 2 to 4 year period. There's a study from McKinsey that says most of this retrofit work will pay for itself within 2 to 4 years, and then you're actually saving money. And in the meantime, you've taken people who need work. Our construction workers are not going to build anything the next 12 months, the next 24 months. We'll let them rebuild everything. Our veterans coming home, folks coming home from prison, our rural youth, our urban youth, people need jobs. And we have this incredible work that needs to be done. It's not like there's no work to be done. Let's connect the people who most need work to the work that most needs to be done, do a smart public-private deal here, and get the economy going.
And speaking about the labor force and all of those people who do need jobs, do they have the skills to carry out what you're describing?
Well, you know, that's the great thing about the green economy. And you know, you mentioned early on, sometimes stuff sounds so vague. It's like the green world. You start thinking about Buck Rogers and, you know, sci-fi jobs and stuff. You know, the number one high-tech tool in developing a green economy is the caulk gun. You know, just going around and making sure that we're weatherizing and that we're efficient, that we're cutting energy demand with the existing off-the-shelf technology. And we can deploy workers right now with very little additional training, sometimes 2 to 3 weeks extra training in our existing job training programs, our community colleges, our vocational schools, to create a green-collar workforce, that can go out there and deploy existing technologies from caulk guns to solar panels to get our energy use down, to bring prices down for energy, and put people to work.
Van, I had no idea how much of a radical you are. I mean, you basically want to just hand out caulk guns to people on the street. Just hand out guns.
Exactly. It's a great thing to be able to say to people. You put down the handgun, pick up the caulk gun. You know, there's a better future. There's a better economy, brother. You know, you can imagine the whole deal. I mean, that is, though, the most important thing that I can say.
Have you figured out where you're going to live in Washington, Van?
What are you talking about?
I have a question for you, Van. What advice do you have to those who are unemployed besides perhaps putting a sandwich board on with your resume attached?
Well, first of all, this is going to be a long recession, and that's just the reality. But I think that, you know, there are certain parts of this economy that we're going to see grow. The president of the United States says he wants 5 million green jobs. The president-elect He says his number one priority besides the financial crisis is energy security. So I think that's a subtle hint to everybody. All things being equal, if you can get into a community college class, you know, on top of everything else that's going on, or if you can at least study up, greening up your resume, mm-hmm. greening up your skill set, I think is very
good idea.
Very smart.
What's your plan B, Van? Last question, quick.
My plan B. I'm doing my plan B. I'm trying to rally the country for green jobs and a clean energy jobs corps to retrofit and repower America.
Oh, man, Van.
This is the man who stays on message, John. Van Jones, thanks for being with us. Van Jones is author of The Green Collar Economy and president and founder of Green for All.
What about that tight Senate race? They're still counting the votes in Georgia, and there's a runoff in play. There's talk of whether Barack Obama will actually support Democratic candidate Jim Martin.
What if Barack Obama puts himself out there, comes to Georgia, tries to energize voters to go out, and then it's not enough? What does that say about Obama? It would be like his first, you know, blemish, basically, on his record.
Susan Capiluto is the news director at Georgia Public Broadcasting, talking about that tight Senate race in Georgia. Susanna.
You said Susan.
Susan, yeah, the brain is gone today. So if you are in these challenging economic times looking for a job or have a suggestion for someone who needs a job, like our pal with the sandwich board on a couple hours ago, what's the most daring or unusual thing you've done to get a job? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Hello? John?
Yeah.
This is The Takeaway.
Yeah, right.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.